he agreed, and he started along with Owlin right behind soon, the northwestern side of the mountain still dark with the morning shadow. Soon after, the two crept to a ridgetop and stared down a small hollow to see an enormous chunk of stone, the massive roof of a black cave at the bottom, hidden behind a small stand of quaking aspens. Owlin toed at the rocky ground before the cave. It had a vaguely crystalline appearance, with edges too sharp and too clean for the mountainside. Talmadge had noticed the strangeness of the cave entrance's appearance too, Owlin noted, and had perked up upon seeing it. "Your debt is paid," Owlin whispered.
"Not yet," he replied. "Not until I talk you out of this madness. You cannot go in there."
Owlin surely understood his sentiment, for the stench of death flowed out of that black opening, assaulting her senses and her courage. "Begone, Talmadge of no tribe, who will not even tell me of his village."
"I have no village. You were born in the forest?"
Talmadge chuckled, despite the grim mood and wretched scent. He pointed out to the east, beyond the plateau, beyond the Surgruag Mornad, beyond even the desert of black stones. "Far away," he said wistfully, "in a land called the Wilderland, though surely a land tame compared to this place, near a great kingdom called Haunts the Bear."
"Haunts the Bear?"
He nodded and smiled.
"There are villages there in Haunts the Bear?"
Owlin asked.
"Many great villages and cities."
Owlin shook her head, not understanding what cities might be.
"Huge villages," Talmadge explained. "Full of houses and towers, and with 100 people for every single lakeman, woman or child, all about Lochbeag, all of them. And the Ushgar too, all of them combined."
His expression grew sly.
"Turn from this place, Owlin of Ushgar," he said. "Come with me to Fusachran on the lake, and then beyond. Come with me to the east, beyond the black stones of Fasailed of Cloch, and I will show you."
Owlin could not deny the curiosity he had aroused in her.
"Beyond the lake? Beyond the mountains?" she asked.
"Aye.
Farther than we can see from the top of Fíorachspuer."
"Aye, much farther." She shook her head.
"There is nothing beyond the horizon."
He laughed again.
"You're smarter than that," he said.
She nodded, and this time smiled back at him. But they both knew that the distracting conversation, for all its delightful possibilities, was at its end.
"Go away, Talmadge. Owlin. You cannot help me in there. You'd get me killed trying to save you."
Talmadge stuttered about for some recourse, but there was none to be found.
"Well, I'm heading down," he said in obvious surrender. "Sun's up, and I've a long walk ahead. Best to be off the mountain before night, or I might get hunted again. Even before night, if it's your Ushgar friends come calling."
"They are not my friends," Owlin thought, but did not say. Talmadge turned and walked away, leaving Owlin crouched at the top of the ridge, staring down at the cave that so fittingly looked like the gaping maw of a hungry demon.
37. The Face of Evil. An exhausted Te Oleg, Egart, and Argmore limped into the Ushgar encampment just as the looming mountain before them began to limn with the light of dawn behind it. Their legs were scratched and bleeding. Egart had turned an ankle and leaned heavily on Argmore for support. Argmore's nose was certainly broken from running into a low limb in the dark. He had crashed to the ground, and remained so still for so long, Te Oleg was sure he had lost another warrior that terrible night. But no, the trio had made it to safety at least, which was more than could be said for Alid. Te Oleg cared little for that, other than the consequences he might face for getting a man killed on a hunt of his calling, and without the sanction of the coven, or the blessing of Ushgar Forfach Raybert. No raid or hunt was supposed to happen without two of the three, Ushgar Forfach, Uskar Regin and Uskar Lauch in agreement. He'd just go to Rabat soon, he decided, before the tribe moved to the winter plateau, and remind the doddering old man that he had been given his agreement for the hunt. Or maybe he'd go to Meeren. The mere thought of confronting the Uskar Regin had the man gnashing his teeth. Behind him, Ogmor and Agart veered off, heading for their tents, and some needed sleep, Teolig knew. He didn't stop them, for both seemed near to collapse, and he certainly understood that feeling. Standing on the edge of camp, most of the Uskar still asleep, Teolig again tried to unwind the surprising events of the previous night. His two surviving minions were despondent, of course, but he was too full of anger to feel that way. Anger at fate for putting a bear in that place at that time. A bear that came to his fossa lure, and in the last blood moon expected for a long while. It had been the worst possible coincidence, a terrible turn of chance that had cost him his planned ascension to Uskar Tríath. He should have the fossa's bloody head in his hands, then, to walk into the camp in triumph. The camp began to stir before him, women appearing to go out and begin the morning meal, men wandering out of their tents to go piss in the woods. None paid particular heed to Teolig, and why should they? Yes, that would be his greatest hope, that no one even knew that he and the three had gone out the previous night. Not much of a hope, though, for it did nothing to alleviate the ambitious man's disappointment. His glory had been stolen away. Ancient Rabert wouldn't live much longer, probably not even until the next blood moon, the next chance for Teolig to put his plan into motion. When Rabert died, Anna May would be named as Uskar Forfach, and that one likely had many years of life ahead of him. Unless an unfortunate accident fell upon him. Teolig didn't like the idea of killing yet another Uskar, and particularly one so venerated, but he liked less the idea that he would be caught there, simply as Uskar Lauch, and even that formidable position would not hold for long, as the younger men sought to take his place. Shorter still might his reign be, if the truth of Relid's death became known. He thought of the bear happening upon the lure, then fighting the four men so determinedly. Food was plentiful this season, and that behavior seemed so unusual, even for an aggressive brown bear. Ogmore and Agart had claimed it was maddened, surely crazed, and driven into them by the fossa, like so many she had been driven across the mountainside under the blood moon previous. But Teolig considered, too, the lightning he had seen behind him. A witch's lightning, to be sure. The fossa might drive even a bear before it, of course. But Teolig suspected that such was not the case. Not this time. Standing there, the camp awakening around him, Teolig became convinced that his plans had been foiled, not by fate, not by a mere bear, not even by the fossa. Meeren? He whispered to himself. Would he find her sleeping in her tent? He growled and scowled, and he stalked off to find out. The stench and the overwhelming sensation of dread nearly stopped Aulën as she approached the dark entryway, a black opening of about waist height beneath the gigantic stone wall. She bent low and called upon her diamond, relieved to see that the floor beyond was a bit lower, so she wouldn't have to crawl through, at least. She wanted to go in, but her legs would not answer her call. She found herself breathing hard, in gasps, and then felt as if she had to remember to breathe, or she would not. The gasps came faster. Aulën's eyes darted about left and right. She looked behind her, expecting to see the monster leaping upon her. She looked into the cave again, and imagined the ghosts of her mother and father flitting about the shadows just outside the perimeter of her magical light. Were they waiting for her here? To welcome her to death?
When she sat down on the ground and slung her legs into the cave, she truly suspected that she was climbing into the realm of death, and not the jeweled shore of Korsaleuk, but the smoky underplain of Ifrien, where the fiends roamed and tormented deserving souls for eternity. Aulin closed her eyes and steadied herself. She thought of the crystal caverns, where the song of Uskar rang supreme. Those were not far from this place, she knew. This place, Firoxbuer, her home. This was not Ifrien before her, she told herself. It only felt that way because of the creature within, because of the demon Fossa. Magic was life, and life was magic, and around the Fossa she had felt neither. She hopped down to the cave floor, ducking so that she didn't crack her head on the low stone of the entryway. She called upon her diamonds to shed brighter light, but held back. She feared to walk in the darkness, of course, but was she making herself an easier target? She let the diamond magic expire, to see how bright the cave would be without it. She ignited it immediately once more, having found herself in a blackness that was not natural. She glanced back at the entry, the exit, and saw the world beyond, waking with the morning light. But it was muted, and seemed so far removed, so far away. Was this Ifrien? He had wanted to stay and ask the girl many, many questions, surely, but he had realized that he would not dissuade her, would not turn her from her course. Nor could Talmadge argue with her reasoning that he would be no help to her, indeed might prove a detriment in the lair of that monstrous creature. He had leaped from the tree upon it, crashing with crushing weight. Had the beast even noticed? It had shrugged him aside and absently whacked him with that terrible sword-like tail, and the only reason Talmadge even had legs left was because he was falling before the blow, and so the tail didn't cut through. Talmadge stopped in his tracks and glanced back up the mountainside. He worried that he was leaving this young woman, this child, to die. The thought of his severed legs had thrown his thoughts back to that awful moment on the banks of Loch Pyug, when he had found the leg of Khote, his dear Khote. Perhaps he had left Khote to die. The breeze picked up, and Talmadge felt the invigorating, unseasonably cold wind on his face, and was reminded of that magical leap, nay, that flight, up into the tree while holding Aulin's hand. He had never seen such a display of magical power. And the fireball! If the Fossa hadn't what? Absorbed it? Eaten it? That expanding blast would have surely lit half the mountain on fire. So perhaps this Aulin would win. He laughed at the absurdity of it all, at his own helplessness, at his own smallness, and continued down the mountain under the sunrise of the brilliant late summer morning. The girl, the strange flying girl, had saved his life beyond any doubt, not simply from the Uskar hunters, but from the giant bear. In his decades on the frontier, Talmadge had never seen a bear behave so strangely. It was almost as if the great predator had come in to protect him from the Uskar. He stopped and pondered. Had the girl done that too? The girl who had thrown lightning and fire, who had healed the deep wound of the crystalline knife, who had shown up at exactly the right moment to save him and get him away from danger. Talmadge ran his hand over the wound, flinching, pained by the slightest touch. The dagger had gone in so very deep, he understood, he knew. The strike had been mortal, surely, for even with the heroic healing, his side remained raw and red. He'd have a mighty scar to add to his collection when it fully healed. Might an Abelican monk have performed this miracle? Would it have had to be an abbot, even the father abbot? Yet here he was, alive. For the first time since the fight, Talmadge truly appreciated how impossible that should have been. "Thanks, girl," he said quietly, his whisper lost to the howling mountain winds. He huddled up against that wind, crouched behind a boulder, unarmed and quite exhausted. A part of him wanted to take a nap, but he didn't dare. He needed to be off the mountain quickly this very day, if possible, and back to the relative safety of Fasokhran. The Uskar were still out there, after all, to say nothing of the demonic beast that had attacked him and the girl. Talmadge glanced back up the mountainside. "The poor, doomed girl," he whispered. An image of Khote flashed in his thought. The last moment he had seen her before the canoe had upended, throwing them both into the water. If Khote had even hit the water, he couldn't be sure, for not a sound had he heard, other than his own desperate splashing as he swam for all his life for the shore. Fleeing, instead of trying to help her. He was not going to do that again. He was too old to add to that burden. Heaving a great sigh, Talmadge fished in his pocket to pull out the crystalline dagger. Such a tiny and inadequate weapon, it seemed. "So be it," he said, and he turned about, fought away his exhaustion, and started back up Firoxbuer. This was death. Not just the stench of death. Not just the coldness of death. No. This was a place of death itself. Magic was life, and life was magic, but here, Aulan wondered if there could exist either. "It killed them," she reminded herself, thinking of her mother and father and all that she had lost. With that in mind, she bravely moved to the low corridor and crept in, and was soon crawling. A diamond light seemed to diminish in there. In this place that was not of magic. She came through to an angled floor with a crawl space that seemed too tight for her to inch through. Every sensibility within the young woman told her to turn back, to run away, to be as far from this awful place as possible. But she found herself flat on her belly, under that too low ceiling, inching forward with grim determination, for she could feel the coldness beyond. The fossa was there, waiting for her. The ceiling above her opened a bit, but she stayed low. The floor before her sloped downward, then disappeared into a dark hole, one that had reminded Aulan of the pit she had encountered in the crystalline caverns beneath the maw of Creus Sadiad. And like there, she could feel the ghosts in here, the lamenting spirits of the fossa's many victims. Was her mother here? She shook the thought out of her head. She couldn't be distracted, not for an instant. She had to be faster than the fossa. It was there, just beyond her, in that pit she knew, she could feel, she could hear. She tapped her foot and brought a field of ice before her on the decline of the stone floor, and some surely falling into the pit beyond. She considered her options. On how she might fight the creature in these quarters, or how she might get out of this compromising position, and focused on the songs of the moonstone and the malachite. She heard a roar, and the fossa leaped up before her to the stone, barely a stride away, its claws raking hard on the icy patch. Aulan cried out and threw forth the power of the moonstone, a blast of wind that slammed the slipping monster and pitched it back over the edge. And Aulan went right to her turquoise and whetstone, and sent her spirit flying behind it, diving down into the most horrible darkness she had ever known, toward the red eyes that peered up at her, and straight into the beast. Immediately, Aulan began again her healing. The demon fossa howled, shrieked, caterwauled, and went into a murderous frenzy that flipped it all about the pit and sent bones flying all about. Inside the creature's senses, seeing through the fossa's eyes, Aulan saw the ghosts swirling about, trapped and crying, the spirits of so many men and women, children even, and a thousand animal spirits as well. Somewhere there was her mother and father, she knew, and she wanted to call to them, to free them. All she could do was cast her healing with all her strength to burn away the demon side of their eternal tormentor. She felt that seething hatred, too, the mind of the monster. Her second wave of assault didn't surprise it, as had her initial intrusion. And now it moved with purpose, scrambling to the back wall of the pit.
No, no, no,
Alan heard her own mouth saying up above, and she brought forth more magical healing, knowing that time was short. The fossa leaped across the pit to the wall, caught on, and leaped back higher the other way.
No,
Alan cried, in her mind and body, for she couldn't defeat it in time, and she was not in her corporeal form to defend. Her spirit flew free as the fossa sprang to the front wall again, up higher, murderous claws catching hold of the stone and launching it back higher on the back wall. Forward it sprang again, but now over the lip, its momentum sliding it up the gradual incline, across the ice, one claw reaching forth to stab and hook Owlin's arm. She just got back into her body, just recovered her senses, and she flew forward, caught by the demon, sliding across her own ice, and falling. Instinctively, purely on terror, the witch grabbed at the malachite to resist the fall, but only minimally succeeded, both Owlin and the demon crashing down hard into the pile of bones, more than one jagged bit stabbing into her. She fled her body again. She had no choice. Into the fossa, assaulting it with waves of Uskar song, with the healing power of the Wedstone. She saw through its demonic eyes as it lunged for her form, tasted her own blood as the fossa chewed into her upper belly and lower rib, tearing her diaphragm, biting for her lungs and heart. Owlin knew pain as never before, knew terror as never before. And so she ran and hid in the only place available. In the song of the Wedstone, in the magic of Uskar. And there she sent forth healing as never before, into the fossa, into herself. And she could feel the monster's agony, could smell its flesh burning. But it was still biting, and her blood was pouring forth, and in this battle the monster's fangs against her healing powers. She could not win. She cried out for her mother. But there was something else. Something she felt from the other gemstone, the turquoise. Something within the demon fossa. Something that it had been. That hated the demon more than all else. Owlin went there. Owlin healed. Trying to keep her body alive. Trying to burn away the demon. The fossa chewed. 38. Talmadge's Tears. Hands on hips, at a loss where to begin, Talmadge almost jumped out of his boots when a large and dark form came charging out of the cave, straight at him. He cried out. He fell back, waving the crystalline dagger somewhat pathetically, and nearly tripped over his own feet and tumbled to the ground. But the charging creature had less interest in fighting him than he had in fighting it, and it skidded to a fast stop and turned sideways to the man, stalking off and never taking its eyes from him. Its feline eyes. For this was no monster, but a cloud leopard, graceful and beautiful. A ferocious predator, to be sure, but a shy one that did not seek out difficult fights. Talmadge eyed it curiously, and began nodding his head at the big cat's profile, as it loped away, low to the ground, long and sleek. Like the monster from the previous night, though with a furry and plump tail, and not some strange sword-like sheaf of bone. When the cat was at last out of sight, Talmadge looked back to the black maw of the cave. It wasn't the leopard's lair, certainly, or the cat would not have run off. But why was it in there? The monster had burrowed through a bear, so what might a leopard do against such power? Or was this the monster? Talmadge had heard tales of creatures that transformed in the dark of night, or under the glow of a full moon. Was this legendary demon a weir creature, perhaps?
It was all too confusing, and interesting, but also quickly dismissed as amusing for another day, when the most pressing question weighed in on Talmadge. What had happened to the young woman, to Aulën of the Uskar?
Oh, by a bell's fat ass!
Talmadge cursed, knowing that he had to go in.
Aulën!
He called, as loudly as he dared, hoping against hope that she was somewhere about out here. He kept calling as he moved about, trying to construct a torch and figure some way to light it. He gave up on that plan quickly, though, with the mountain wind howling. So he sighed and went to the opening, bent down, and peered in. He noted a shallow cave, and would have thought it nothing more, except he noted an opening in the back of it, a tunnel leading farther in. He had to go there, for the only reason he could even note that passageway was because a light was coming from it, thin but consistent. The light of a magical diamond, Talmadge knew. The young Uskar woman was back there. He looked around for the leopard, but it was not to be seen. Could she possibly still be alive? He hopped into the cave and moved to the passageway, which had a lower ceiling. He went in, crouching, but gave up on that and crawled. He went around a bend cautiously, the light growing at that corner, and found that the passage opened up for a slanted floor, the uneven top of a gigantic stone with only a tiny clearance to the rough stone ceiling above. The thought of crawling through such a space terrified Talmadge. Monster or no monster on the other end, but Aulën was back there. Or at least, her diamond light was back there.
Aulën!
He called, for if there was a monster back there, it was going to catch him whether he was silent or not.
Girl! Are you there?
He paused and listened, but heard only the wind moaning through the entry cavern behind him. He lay on his stomach and squeezed under the ceiling, and began inching through. He called to Aulën repeatedly, but heard no reply. All he knew was the diamond light, and a stench, growing stronger with every inch, and a sense of cold, deathly cold, that he had never known before. But Talmadge kept going. He thought of Khote, and decided that no, he wasn't going to leave this lovely young woman who had saved his life.
Come on, monster,
he growled under his breath, knife firmly in hand. The young woman was dead, he believed, and so there was no justice in the world. No beneficent god rewarding heroes and punishing demons. That thought chased him through the tight crawl space, burning at him, assaulting him. By the time he came to the wider area just beyond, a dark hole before him, he was too angry to be afraid. Now that terrible smell of death only made him want to fight, and now the sudden and empty cold.
Cold? He whispered in surprise.
Talmadge put his hand before him to test the stone ahead once more, but pulled it back immediately, for the stone there was much colder, was frozen and slick with ice, and actually hurt to touch.
Aulën!
He breathed, remembering her actions the previous night. He lifted his head as high as he could go, and noted the pit. The light was coming from in there, he could tell, casting a glow up the back wall. That back wall held him transfixed for a long moment, staring at the gouges in the stone, claw marks as profound as a great cat might do to a stand of soft clay. He searched about, and pulled out the cord he had taken from the tree the night before, finding a jag where the ceiling met the floor where he could tie off one end. Wrapping the other end securely about his hand and arm, Talmadge inched forward, trying to see over the rim, and whispering Aulën's name. He came to the cold area, but kept going, peering intently, and he finally came to where he was able to look over the ledge. There she was, sitting against the wall on a mound of bones. Unmoving, the front of her clothing drenched in blood.
Aulën! He yelled. Uskar girl! She didn't stir.
Talmadge lowered his head in despair. She was dead. She had to be.
She was too still. There was too much blood.
He thought he should go and retrieve the body. But he didn't even know how he might do that, for the cord wasn't long enough. He said a prayer for Aulin, for this wonderful and strange young woman who had so bravely saved him, and he started back.
And he slipped on the ice and slid back the other way, over the lip of the pit.
The cords tightened on his forearm painfully as he struggled, and he had nothing to grab onto, nowhere to put his foot even, for the side of the pit, too, was covered in magical ice. So he hung there, and he flailed for a bit, grimacing against the pain, and thought himself stupid indeed. For if anyone came here in the future, they would find him hanging here, dead.
Finally, overcome with frustration, Talmadge brought up the crystal knife and cut the cord. He dropped the final 10 feet to the bones, crunching and shifting beneath him.
Idiot, he cursed himself, and he realized that he had to go and search the body to find the gemstone that she had used to lift them the previous night, and hope that he could bring forth enough magic to get him back up to the ledge. He moved over her tentatively, unsure, not wanting to desecrate her. He moved her shirt aside to inspect the mortal wound. A deep gash at the bottom of her ribcage. No, more than a gash. More like a burrow. And he thought of the bear the previous night.
Oh, poor girl, he whispered.
He noticed the diamond, too, glowing brilliantly from a strand on an unusual belly ring she wore. Truly, Talmadge had never seen anything like it, with its 4 strands each ended by a different gem, obviously magical. At least the diamond.
Girl,
he asked repeatedly, moving very close, trying to make sure that she had expired before he took her gemstones, a task that seemed more difficult now, for that belly ring seemed quite secure, and he might have to cut it off her. He hugged her close, whispering comforting words to her, though he knew she could not hear. He said another prayer, though he had no god of his own, and knew nothing about any Aulin might care for. He slid his hands down to grab the grey hub of her jewellery, closing his finger securely to see if he could somehow ease it out. And there he found her, found Aulin, the thinnest strand of life.
Girl? Girl!
He said, grabbing her face with his other hand and shaking it about, trying to stir her, to no avail. She seemed quite dead, but he felt her life in his other hand, in that stone. No, he realized, not in the stone, but through the stone. Talmadge was not practiced or trained in the use of gemstones. His only experience with magic came from the clairvoyance crystal in his pocket. He closed his eyes now, though, and he felt the magic in the grey stone on Aulin's belly, and he knew then that it was what the monks of Abel called a soul stone, the stone they used in healing. And this was the stone Aulin had used to heal him. Twice.
Please, please, please,
Talmadge kept repeating, trying to focus all of his thoughts on that soul stone. His whispers died away when he heard the song in the stone, and he went to it and embraced it, and tried to give it somehow to the poor woman. But he could not. No matter how hard he tried, Talmadge did not know how to cast such a spell. He could hear the magic, could even call back to it and amplify the song, but no more. And he realized that he couldn't save Aulin, that the tiny flicker of life remaining within her was going to snuff out while he held her there in his arms, in that pit of death. He began to cry. He cried for Chote. He cried for Aulin. Te Oleg was barely halfway to Meryn's tent when Conombra intercepted him.
Are you just returning? The witch asked.
He stared at her hard, trying to intimidate her and back her away from those dangerous questions. Normally that would work on the malleable Conobra, but this time
She held her ground, though her expression was hardly confrontational.
"Have you seen your wife?"
Conobra asked, and Teolig surrendered his imposing stare for one of surprise. "What about her?"
I assumed that she would be with you.
He realized then that Conobra hadn't been accusing him of anything with her first question, but that hardly seemed to matter at the moment anyway.
"She is not in her tent?" he asked.
"She is nowhere that I can find."
"And you, Skarrigin?"
the war leader snapped. He thought back to the previous night in light of this new information.
"Seeking Erlin."
"Where is she?"
"I do not know. I just asked you."
"Not Erlin," Teolig snapped. "Where is Merin?"
Conobra nodded for the Crystal Maven's tent. Teolig waved her away and started for Merin once more. The commotion about the camp increased around him as he went. The Uskar were already on edge with Gavina's death, the early onset of winter, and so, likely, the early climb to the winter plateau, and with the blood moon of the previous night, and so whispers of missing Aulan, and then of another disappearance, that of Ralid, began to echo about. More than one glance fell on Teolig as well, and why not, since his wife and a man of about her age were both apparently absent from the camp? Teolig pondered the possibilities here. Perhaps rumors of a tryst between the two would be the best course of action. His own reputation would be sullied, of course, for being cuckolded by a man as mediocre as Ralid. But that might be better than having to admit that he led the missing man to his death in an unsanctioned hunt for the demon Fossa. All of that was bouncing around his thoughts when he pushed into Meryn's tent to find her sitting with a couple of other witches.
"Begone," he ordered,
and the two looked to Merin, who was staring at Teolig, at his uncompromising visage. She nodded, and they scurried away.
"What have you done?"
Merin asked when they were alone.
"Nothing that concerns you."
"If it concerns Aulan, who seems to be missing..."
"Aulan is often missing," Teolig interrupted.
"If it concerns her, it concerns me."
"If it concerns her, then that is of her doing, not mine. When did you last see her?"
Merin looked at him curiously, as if to ask what business that might be of his. Aulan was to enter the coven, after all, and so Merin's claim on the young woman would be stronger than any Teolig might make.
"When did you last see her?" he asked again, slowly, enunciating each word clearly and powerfully.
"When we returned from Gavina's grave, soon after sunset."
She cocked her head, studying his expression.
"What do you know?"
"Not enough," he replied.
"Are we to trust each other or not?"
"My plans last night were foiled," he admitted. "And Ralid is not missing. He lies dead far from here."
Merin sighed and shook her head, but Teolig added sharply,
"Foiled by a witch, I believe."
"What do you mean?"
Now it was his turn to shake his head, and he added a little snarl for good measure. He told Merin then, with minimal detail, about the fight with the brown bear.
"The beast ran us off," he finished, "and looking back from on high revealed to us the magic of a lightning stroke. The magic of a witch."
"The magic of Aulan?"
Merin asked, and Teolig shrugged.
"Aulan could not direct a bear,"
Merin said.
"There are crystals with such magic."
"For a bird, or a small newt, but not a..."
"Do not underestimate that one," Teolig warned. "I saw her, fighting through Breath on the field that day. You think me foolish for choosing her as my wife, but I saw her, her power bared."
"She is undeniably strong in the Song of Uskard," Merin admitted, "but what you claim is beyond."
"I make no claims. I ask questions, and I will find answers."
"To control a giant bear?" Merin laughed. "Who would even think to try such a foolish thing?"
Teolig fixed her with a stare to let her know in no uncertain terms that her mocking tone was not appreciated.
"What would you have me do?"
Merin asked more seriously.
If the idiot girl even returns alive, I mean.
She has been announced for the coven, but I can...
She will be in the coven,
Teyalig decided.
And we will watch her, both of us.
And she will do as I need, as we need, or we will reveal her treachery and feed her to Kres Adiet.
Meryn agreed with a nod. Outside the tent, so did Connabra, who had heard every word. She paused before entering, then went in a rush to confirm to Meryn and the Uskarlauch that yes, Aulën was indeed missing from the camp, and that another warrior Ralid was also gone. Teyalig rushed back outside, moving quickly to the tent of Egart, his nephew, then to Argmor, rousing his soldiers. There was no time for sleep.
"Gather others," he told them, "and go in search of Aulën."
"Aulën?"
they asked together.
"She is not to be found."
"The lightning!" Egart gasped.
"Shut up!" Teyalig was fast to reply. "There was no lightning."
To Egart he added quietly, "You lead a group down to Ralid, and there find signs of Aulën's passage, whether she was there or not." The younger man seemed confused.
"Sneak into her tent and gather some of her things," Teyalig spelled it out.
"I will go with you,"
Ogmar said, but Teyalig held up his hand.
"You will go out alone," he instructed Ogmar. "To Elder Rebert. Tell him of the missing, and ask him for his guidance. And check on the idiot Umas who works the way.
The one Aulën favors,"
said Egart, remembering that long-ago painful incident. Teyalig shot him a threatening stare, even though he agreed with the sentiment. In his improvisation here, that's where his thoughts had led him. He could perhaps force Aulën's silence if necessary, if it was her at the bear fight, and if she was even still alive and soon to return, by using the threat of murdering the Umas boy against her. The two young warriors stared at him with puzzled expressions.
"No one can know," he explained in a deadly serious tone, letting the weight of doom hang with every word.
Egart looked at him doubtfully, even shook his head a little bit.
Teyalig understood, and perhaps it would be better to just tell the truth of the previous night, of how their grand plan to be rid of the fossa was ruined by bad happenstance with a giant bear. Or better still, to not find Ralid, and not plant evidence of Aulën having been there. But no, he decided to stick with his instincts here. Meryn was with him, Raybert a doddering old fool. Unless these two foolishly revealed something, the only one who could possibly hurt him was Aulën. But if he could so easily implicate and discredit her, and threaten her with the Umas boy, better to set that battlefield, if it was to come, with all conditions against the young witch. It took a long while for Talmadge to realize that he had done something terribly wrong here. He had mentally reached out to the magic in the grey soul stone, but not as he had intended, apparently, for he began to feel quite strange, suddenly. Detached from himself. He knew that he should let go of the stone, but his hand wouldn't answer his call. So suddenly, his own body seemed no more a part of him than the dying Aulën's corporeal form. Terror gripped him. He would die here, too, his spirit unbound. His mortal coil settling there, expiring. And he was not alone. But no, not the monster, not the demon, Talmadge suddenly realized. And he recognized the spirit, Aulën's spirit, and thought he was there, at the moment of her death, watching her soul separate from her body. He didn't know what to think or do, didn't know if he should feel blessed to witness such a moment of peaceful transfer, or horrified that he, too, would likely follow her spirit to the netherworld, whatever that might mean.
"Aulën,"
he said, not with his lips, but with his thoughts. He couldn't see her spirit, exactly. It was more as if he could sense it, feel it,
but he was sure that she heard.
Aulin,
he thought again, and he flooded her with thoughts of sadness and regret, and the image of both of them there in the pit of death, his hand gently set upon her bare belly.
Aulin!
And then he could see her spirit, as if it were floating away, leaving her lifeless coil. But no, he realized, the spirit wasn't Aulin, though the image seemed very much like the Uskar woman.
Who are you?
He wondered. The spirit didn't answer, but flew right down to him and engulfed him, and he felt to dissipate as if to nothingness. And a great sadness fell over him, one that broke his inadvertent magic spell of spirit-walking and sent him flying back to his body, where he closed his physical eyes and sobbed. And then stopped, abruptly, and opened his eyes wide when he felt Aulin's hand over his own. And felt, too, a sudden surge of magic, more glorious than Talmage had ever before known. Epilogue. She stood outside the cave, staring at the blackness, thinking of the spirits, the demon, the man she had killed, the man she had rescued, thinking about life itself and what it meant when death arrived. She had set the cloud leopard free of its demon possessor. She had set the spirits free of their demon captor. And one of those spirits, a very special one, had helped her hear the song to guide her from the edge of oblivion.
Ilara,
Aulin whispered, and she slapped her hand over her mouth and began to sob, overwhelmed beyond anything she had ever imagined. Ilara, a name she hadn't known before, but would never forget. She couldn't believe that she had gone into that pit of death. She believed even less that the stranger, Talmage, had gone in after her. She wanted to dismiss the memory of her fight. That sickly, awful, excruciating feeling of the demonic creature burrowing into her belly, chewing her flesh as it devoured her life energy, tearing at her gut to create a battle between the carnage and the healing. Aulin's magic holding back the monster, like the lakeshore against the waves blown on a gale. Aulin fell to her knees, and threw her other arm across her belly, reflexively bending forward as she knelt to cover up her wound. She still couldn't comprehend the reality of that fight, the very edge of her bone-pile grave, or that she had somehow come through it. Composing herself, she turned about and sprinted up the wall of the vale to the ridge where she and Talmage had first seen the cave. She looked for him up there, but he was already too far down the mountain, out of sight. He had offered to take her with him, down to the lake towns, and then across the lake, and across the world, to this village he called Haunts the Bear. After yet another incident revealing the indecency of her people, and with her own curiosity for the wider world, Aulin had wanted to accept that offer more than a little. But no, she could not. She was to be brought into the coven, to learn more secrets of Uskar, to become powerful among her people. She had defeated the demon Fossa. Te Oleg had meant to do that, and used the feat to gain control of the tribe. But now, Aulin had done it. What might she do with that heroic act? What changes might she bring? She had seen the truth of Uskar's magic more keenly than any others, she believed. But to what end? What now would be her purpose? It was too overwhelming for the woman, emotionally and physically exhausted, her heart wounded, her soul confused. She wanted to go with Talmage, she couldn't deny, but she could not. Not now. What might happen to Badlan if she walked away? With a long last glance at the terrible cave, Aulin started off around Firoxbuer, Not for the Uskar camp quite yet, though. Instead, she called upon her gemstones, floated and flew, and ran from tree to high stone to tree again, up the mountain, towards the peak where the snow was soon to fall once more, and where the remnants of the last dusting remained in the shadowed areas. Talmadge moved with all speed down the side of the mountain, but despite his urgency, he knew that winter was coming fast, and knew, too, that so were the Uskar. He couldn't help but pause and glance back repeatedly, his thoughts flooding with images of that strange young woman who had saved him, and whom he had saved. The moments in the pit, lost on the edge between life and death, had taken his breath away, and still had him shaking his head in disbelief. The road of his life's journey had nearly ended, but in that desperate moment, teetering on the edge, it had widened to lengths he had never before imagined. He knew that he would never view the moments of his life the same way. For where before Talmadge had felt a sense of dread and loss, now he felt a strange and glorious elation. And freedom. Freedom from the ghosts of his past, as surely as the ghosts in that pit had found freedom. There was magic in the world, he knew now, in ways he had never even considered. And magic was life. And life was magic. He pulled out the crystalline dagger and held it up, seeing the flakes within. He understood more about the Uskar now, and he would tell the folk of Fossachran and all the other towns. The Uskar were not demons, but mortal men. The echo of some voices off a stony front to the side of Talmadge reminded him that he was not alone on this mountain. Aulan had assured him that the Uskar hunters would be out to retrieve the dead man, and likely in search of her as well. He veered the other way, into a deep hollow, disappearing into the trees, moving with all speed for all his life, carrying with him the dagger, his insights, and the memory of an exceptionally brave young woman. She cried as much as she laughed, and did both more than she should have. She tried to hold fast to her determination, but the passing hours carried with them doubts and harsh reality. And the memory of that young man named Dralid, a young man she had swatted with the paw of a giant bear, tearing him, sending him, spinning him to crash catastrophically into the thick trunk of a tree. She could see him in her mind's eye, always there, crumbled and dead at the base of that tree. Did she really expect to change them, or impress them, or gain some measure of respect among them? Them, the ferocious warriors and stubborn witches? They would laugh at her and her tales of demons defeated. Meryn would melt her when she discovered the blasphemy, that Aulan had shattered crystals in the caverns to extract the gemstones now pierced to her body. The doubts chased Aulan every step. The fears fluttered up around her like the black form of the fossa, like the flying splinters of shattered bones crushed in the demon's deadly maw. On a high ledge, buffeted by cold winds, Aulan paused and grabbed at her belly, feeling the tenderness of a wound that should have ended her life. Even now, she couldn't believe any of it had been real. Even though she felt the residual pain and profound soreness from the garish attack of the fossa, Aulan could hardly comprehend that the toothy maw had burrowed into her, as it had wormed right through the giant bear, leaving it dead in the clearing. Madness. It was all madness. She stood up tall on the jag of stone, letting the wind buffet her. She didn't huddle under her clothes against the chill breeze. Quite the opposite. She lifted her tattered shirt high, higher, to reveal the reddened area of injury, then pulled it right over her head. She spotted a patch of snow in the shadow of a great stone off to the side, and rushed to it, quickly removing her pants. She lay in the snow and rolled in it, wanting to feel the biting cold on every inch of her body. This was not the coldness of death, Not that profound and frightening cold she had known in the lair, and in the heart of the fossa. No. This was a sensation to affirm her life, to tickle her and nip at her, and bring her sensibilities fully to this mortal coil that contained her spirit. More than once, Aulan thought of soaring down the mountainside to find Talmadge, to run away to a new reality, far removed from the complications of Usgar, god and tribe. Would she then be truly free? But no, she could not, even doubting her grandiose plans. For one simple reason, Aulan could not leave. Badlan needed her. Te Orlig's last words to Badlan rang in her ears, that awful threat. Aulan threw on her clothes, and gathered up her courage, and her magic, and leaped away, speeding across the mountainside. She landed and leaped, long and far, again and again, until at last she came to the way. She tried to paste a kind of smile onto her face as she approached the young man, who was hard at his work, setting another stone step into its carved spot. As she neared, Badlan looked up and smiled wide, but only for a heartbeat, before his jaw dropped and his expression became one of horror. Aulan stopped with surprise, and returned his look with one of puzzlement, until she realized the truth of the image she was presenting, for the front of her clothing hung tattered and dark with dried blood. Her blood. Aulan, the Umus breathed, and he stumbled over the step he was setting in a weak-kneed effort to approach. She ran down to him and wrapped him in a hug, whispering in his ear that she was okay. She even lifted her shirt for him to show him that the wound had healed. Still, it took him a long while to get his breathing back under control after the shock and the terror. Aulan pulled him to the side and sat him down on a flat stone, then knelt beside him. "You must never tell," she instructed, and he shook his head, at a loss. So she told him everything. She told him about the four warriors and the prisoner, and that they were trying to lure the demon Fossa. "I became a bear," she told him, and he gasped and leaned back to better study her. "I didn't become a bear, but I possessed one, and I chased them away to save the man, a man from across the lake and beyond the mountains." She was rambling then, but she didn't slow, and told him of the poor bear dying to the fossa, and of all the rest, to the fossa's lair, to the edge of death. When she finished, she took Badlan's hands in her own. "Do you know what this means?" she asked. He shook his head. "It means that I am not afraid of them any more," Aulan said, and she believed it. She cupped his face in her hands and moved very close to him and promised, "I'm not going to let them kill you." Badlan stared into her black eyes for a long while, before finally nodding, and Aulan then wrapped him in a great hug. She had no idea of how she might possibly fulfill that promise, but in that moment, it didn't matter. She had fought the demon, had gone to the edge of death and even a bit beyond. Yet here she was, and here the fossa was not. And Alara was at peace, and so it was with her. Not so far away, crouched behind a stone, Agmor heard every word and saw, his face scrunched in disgust, every hug. He didn't know what to think in that shocking moment. Part of him wanted to throw a spear into Aulan for killing Ralit. Another part wanted to praise her for saving the poor prisoner. The enormity of it all kept him in place, though, and silent. Not only was Aulan alive and out of the camp, but she was here with this Umus. This Umus who was not stupid. "You should go to my mother," he heard the Umus say. "She will give you new clothes." Agmor grimaced, picturing the torture Te Arlig would inflict on this slave, and probably on his mother, too. and Aulin. That foolish and impertinent girl, the killer of Ralid, would be fed to